And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being a land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, with 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Welcome, welcome, good morning to the Three Left Show.
Hello.
Good morning.
Welcome. This is your host, Dan Platt, Three Left Show. The show kicking off the Saturday political block once again, time. This is Three Lefts. We do radical left-wing politics, as the intro kind of, if you gave it a gist of, it's the fourth intro I put together. No swearing. Clean, good for radio, but still dangerous, idea wise. So we'll just kick it. Happy is almost
Autism Acceptance Month.
Oh, not to go beyond awareness, because we actually need to accept people.
Well, yeah,
because we're very aware of autism, right? I mean, I feel like you go down the street, you ask someone. If they know someone who's autistic, they'd be like, oh, yeah, my neighbor. Oh, yeah, my, you know.
That's how it
starts. Well, people might think they're aware, but the awareness campaign is being led by allistics, non-autistic people with an agenda to stir up fear about autistics. So,
can you give an example of that?
Oh, let's see. Well, Autism Speaks founders Bob and Suzanne Wright used to donate to selective abortion because
scary.
Autism is an epidemic that needs to be cured or eliminated.
So there's a little bit of eugenics kind of thought going on there. Giving kids bleach, among other things.
Yeah.
And other horrible sounding things. And an example is on social media. You've kind of stepped up to be kind of an ambassador of sorts. And so if any discussion happens, you're to be tagged.
Yes.
So you can jump in and assert yourself as someone who actually is on the spectrum and has deep experience with the institutions of power that have wrought on you.
I do have to question, and this is just curiosity. When you say selective abortion, and them donating or supporting selective abortion, I mean, wouldn't it be the parents' right to decide whether they want to raise an autistic child or not? No?
Nope. Would you say the parents have a right to determine if they want to raise a child with brown eyes?
I would say it's their right to choose if they want to choose a child. Like, I would think it's the parents' choice.
I mean, if they might have a right to put that child up for adoption, they don't have the right to decide that child doesn't have a right to live ahead of time.
We're talking about conceptual rights, not rights outlined.
Yeah,
just to clarify, because I'm sometimes muddy.
It's a very muddy topic. Honestly, it's really
there's the ethics.
I understand the fact that you eliminating that person just because of a trait that they carry, and I understand the hypocrisy and this sociopath that just, like, I understand
antisocial behavior, yeah.
The
yeah,
craziness
anti-social.
In that, but I mean, at the same time, I would think it'd be the parents' decision whether they want to raise a child, whether it's autistic or not, doesn't really matter. But
Well, that's why, I mean, I'm supportive of abortion rights.
Yeah.
Pro-abortion, even. But not in cases where it's...
Not in research where you can, you know, you research their...
typology.
Almost yeah. like your...
selective breeding.
I am for abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not for giving people the right to decide that based on the idea that something is wrong with their child.
Completely. Yeah. Yeah. I understand that. Okay.
Because
I can follow you on that for sure.
To make it a kind of real, the real life kind of eugenic is that, you know, in the China's one child policy created because of the let's see, social politics of China, being patriarchal as it is, femme or female assigned, you know, children were then disregarded, aborted, even killed after birth. Mm. To follow those rules first because of neo-Malthusianism, Malthusian thinking, and second, that some lives are valued more than others.
Mm.
And a baseline value right. that undercuts the ethics we're talking about is the value to value diversity. Diversity, variety is the spice of life, makes things worth living, or rather it is a very, it's inherent to life itself. You know, there's no ecosystem without variety, and a human social ecosystem is only healthy when there's variety. Take it out and it's stagnant, and then crises will occur, a la The Village and other such horror movie examples.
I haven't heard of The Village. What?
The Shyamalan film where it's an isolated...
Oh, that's why I haven't heard of it.
The twister at the end. Yeah, yeah. It's a flip on...
And they're in modern times, but they're just so isolated that they're genetically broken.
It's the idea of having a utopia in this day and age, and by doing that, you need to isolate
yourself.
Good people, so to speak, and go back to the good old days. Yeah,
good pure people, which apparently there are. I saw a tweet of that was being shared of a Trump advisor, one of many left.
Oh yes,
but the ones that are left are truly the. So she mentions, you know, Obama was born in Kenya, and Romney was born in Mexico.
These
are there
facts.
Any pure breeds left?
Oh boy.
Mm. Like a Death Eater from Harry Potter. And but yeah, you know, and it's there are some signs as you know, some nerds were pointing out just like how much it hurt to see certain signs at the March for Our Lives that were like, you know, they defeated Voldemort by disarming him. Well, I'm pretty sure they were armed with wands, too.
Yeah.
And it was about organizing marginalized groups and to take out the power base that he held.
Let's be real. There were no marginalized groups in Harry Potter.
Yeah, I'm glad we're...
No. Centaurs, Muggleborn.
Yeah, Lips. But, like, the Centaurs didn't really have a role in the defeat of Voldemort. They just got it...
What? They helped at the end.
All right, I'll retract.
Your memory might be. I have.
I mean, I love how we're judging modern day politics or
by comparing it
to a fictional. I mean, don't get me wrong. Harry Potter.
We just did it Thursday with Star Wars.
That's Star Wars. But Harry Potter is by far one of the best chronological wizard documentation fan fiction. In this day and age.
What? But, are you even trying to say?
Fan fiction.
I don't know. I don't see what has to do with politics. I mean...
Oh, it's inherently political. Voldemort is fascist.
Well, everything is political, but
yes.
Harry Potter is explicitly political.
It's that nebulous...
metaphors
sorry.
For political positions and et cetera, et cetera.
Totalitarianism is bad and fascism's kind of built on... race or other type of, you know, hating on other people.
So if you read between the lines of Harry Potter, the wands maybe represent guns, and the guns maybe represent...
They're in every tool. It's a thing. See, weapons are a type of tool. Wands are pretty much can
so
do
the
everything.
So fascist wizards
You can
are...
kill, you can make fire, you can build a chair.
Okay.
Oh, so, you know.
I was just thinking, like, so the fascist wizards are putting down the muggle.
And muggles us. like non-magical people. Like that's their ideology is that.
Well, maybe you're Muggle, magic. But I know I'm not.
Okay. I'm just kidding. What else? What are you not telling us? The well, you know, it's implicit that like they want to be above everyone else, and that they're probably go public eventually and take over at least Britain. But it's or run everything from the shadows.
That's like where I find the satire in is we're looking at a British book mm-hmm. when we are living in America.
America?
America.
America.
And I just feel like can't we look at maybe a better series, like maybe Game of Thrones, and relate to it to Game of Thrones?
We should go back to a medieval context. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry.
I mean, yeah, Game of Thrones is...
People love fantasy. Partly.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's pre-modern. There's no bureaucracy. If you want to cut to the top, you can literally cut your way to the top. No red tape in your way.
There's no enclosure laws or there's...
Mm-hmm.
The
people know their place. There's nobles with titles and you know that they're better than you.
And there's peasants that
are totally... I mean, do they play a part? I do not watch Game of Thrones.
I would think the peasants play a part because they bring the Lord the food. And
Well, certainly. They are the foundation of which... But I mean, do they have an active role in their destinies?
In Game of Thrones, yes. But it has been too long since I watched or read it for me to point out specific examples.
Yeah, I couldn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't get into details.
The only thing I saw was a clip where someone was like, oh, you know, we should just take, you know, we should not have kings. And like, oh, that's anarchy. And like, you need to replace that with something, which is a fair point. So, but in the world that it exists in, just as in the Renaissance, you know, what do you replace it with? And that's what kind of gave birth to political philosophy in the first place, a la Machiavelli. And other thinkers at the time who were trying to be more realist in their approach of how do our nobles actually operate, not just what they say or how we hold them up as virtuous or godly, but what are they actually doing? And that apparently makes him a villain because he was being real. but that's another discussion. But to turn back to autistic acceptance.
That was quite a tangent.
To counter the propaganda or the way, just like with Pink Ribbons, what Autism Speaks does. How can we, with their blue ribbons? Well, I mentioned the Pink Ribbons because of the pervasiveness of that. And I suppose that's going to they're working to be the next Komen Foundation.
Well,
how do we counter that, Isaac?
All right, so I have a brief list of points here on how people can actually support autistics during Autism Acceptance Month.
Great bullet list, love it.
Yeah. First off, actually call it Autism Acceptance Month instead of Autism Awareness Month. Awareness is fraught, and it's not enough. It's not enough. We need to actually support and accept autistic people. Do not promote light it up blue or puzzle pieces. Google Autism Speaks hate group to learn more. Use identity first language, that is, I am autistic, they are autistic, instead of that person has autism or they are a person with autism. But if an autistic person calls themselves a person with autism, don't tell them not to. They have the right to decide for themselves. Don't use scare terms like suffering with autism or afflicted with autism. Don't use functioning labels like high functioning or low functioning or severe autism. When in doubt, ask an autistic and learn more by visiting autistic-run organizations like the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network and the Autism Women's Network.
Which is actually run and managed by autistics.
Yes.
Instead of their parents who are ashamed of them or think of them as simply burdens because raising such children is difficult.
Parents who claim to be proud of their autistic kids mm-hmm. have a lot of problematic
views
about them.
I mean, I do not mean to take any side here, but how hard is it to grow up in this world, being an autistic kid, this autistic world? I mean, I could understand, of course, being aware, and I'm not saying that an autistic kid is a burden, but certainly trying to show your kid this autistic world would be a burden, right? Like saying, hey, this world is made for you, but...
It's difficult, but only because we as a society make it so.
Yeah.
So, like, what our responsibility as holistics is, or as a society as a whole, is to accommodate the variety in humanity. So, to put it in example, those in wheelchairs. We accommodate them by building ramps. Now, when the ADA was first passed, a whole gamut of groups, architects, contractors, property owners, all opposed it. Oh, it's taking away their rights as property owners or as designers. But not thinking about the rights.
And to win the rights of disabled people to access spaces.
Yeah.
They had to climb up the steps of the U.S. Capitol with other wheelchairs. They were crawling.
Right.
And that's what it took.
To make your point, yeah. And then maybe Republicans responded. But of course, then architects changed their mind immediately, because then they kind of tweaked their ideology to, like, oh, this is actually about allowing more people to access our work.
Right.
And so they do immediately change their mind about that, but that's because they're more artists than owners. They interact with owners, so they got their kind of vibes of, like, oh, this is about restricting us. But a good designer, a good practitioner of anything, knows that restrictions help you achieve more or to be more creative. That's kind of like one of the elements of creativity, is to have a restriction in the first place. When you're not restricted, then you got to either go in a bunch of different directions and then you're indecisive, or you go really far, as far as you can go in one direction, and it's totally out of whack. Just remember to tone it down, taupe. All right. So, and we appreciate anyone who underwrites.
With that being said,
station.
Every suit I've ever bought was from the Salvation Army. So, thank you.
They're totally homophobic. So, my father wore for them at one time when in the 70s.
Or maybe it was Goodwill. I'm not sure. I get them confused. Is that the same, Salvation Army, Goodwill?
No,
it's different.
Yeah.
Different.
Goodwill is the place on
Central, at
Fuller. And then Salvation Army is the big brick building on Clinton. So we're going to change tax now. Bad news, but also normal. It's normal, and that's what's truly terrible about it. So we're going to turn our attention to Gaza and Israel, which we'll link into the next story we'll do. But first, some context with very recent news from yesterday. Going with The Guardian. So I think every year there's a march for the right to return. The right to return refers to Palestinians' ability to go back to where they used to live. Because over the last, the history of Israel, Palestinians bit by bit have been removed with force from where they live. And, after centuries and centuries, their families have roots there. Whether or not, it's not about biblical claims to me. It's about use. They're using the land, they live there, it's theirs. But a matter of not sharing it or buying it, it was taken by force, and that's kind of the crawl of it.
Which kind of makes sense. I mean, with Native Americans, we're not about to give back all of their land that we took.
Right.
We would
like to. I'd like to. And it is a start just to, like, say, give out back the land that they want. Like, they can specifically outline, we want at least these parts back.
Do you know what the real estate value of Manhattan Island is? Just the island of Manhattan.
Well, we could start with just
a lot more than they were paid for it.
Yes.
A lot more than beads and
yeah, and I'm sure the plenty say, oh, we added the value, and yes, that's true. The value of workers. Who were not paid, who were also underpaid and so on. So anyway, so to do a colonialist project like that, where you basically displace people and act in the way of, you know, 20th century war and peace and enforce your borders, nation state stuff, you know, it's like, so Israel's just doing what every other empire has ever done. But they're doing it now. They're doing it post-UN, and they were able to do that with the support of America. The UN was created by America to enforce American hegemony, meaning control.
Growing up, I always thought the United Nations was America. I didn't see a distinction between the two.
And that, well, can't blame me for that.
Largely.
Can't blame you for that. So a big march, right to return, and to enforce their border, because borders are so great, not. They shot, the current count is 773 people shot with live ammunition.
Jesus.
Why don't they just build a wall, man? I don't get
they
it.
Have oh. many walls.
Yeah. Oh.
Militarized walls. And in fact, the border is like a big ditch. So yeah. like people are trying to cross it. And then they threw mortar and all this stuff. And point out, the New York Times, record of note that it is, liar into war that it has done. And that's what the left means if we ever call it fake news, is that they actually lie and misrepresent, is that they're calling these clashes.
Right.
The Palestinians have confronted Israel, and thus they were met with apparently appropriate response.
Almost like the hit game Clash of the Titans. Or is that a game? What? I don't know. I just clash think of Clash. I think of Clash as just like being a game. Not a war, or
a conflict between two equal groups. Mm-hmm.
No less.
They did the same thing during Charlottesville, where they would say, you know, the Antifa and the Patriot groups clashed. When Heather Heyer was run down with a car, that was the result of a clash.
It sounds like a hit and run, not a clash.
When the cops shoot an unarmed black man because he was holding
a cell phone,
they're not calling that a clash, but they might as well, the way it's talked about. So let's go through some details here. At least 15 killed.
See, yeah, a clash.
I
don't think of anyone dying in a clash. I think of like a bar brawl
or a skirmish between two factions or something. Gaza hospitals, running low on blood and overstretched by a huge number of wounded, were reeling with one of the enclave's bloody. And this is, by the way, a completely unarmed, nonviolent. This is the SALT march, the march across Birmingham Bridge, whatever it's called, I forget. It was like that, and
I was.
So, Ministry of Health reports. Israeli soldiers shot 773 people with live ammunition. 15 of the wounded died, said a ministry spokesman. Most of the dead were aged between 17 and 35. The injuries were on the upper part of the body, he added. The remainder of the wounded, some of whom were in critical condition, have been shot with live ammunition. I saw this morning a video taken of a group running away from the border, and one of them, you know, you just watch him being shot.
And these are just people who were seeking to cross the border, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was
so
the point
it's
of it.
Not like the it's not the total casualties and injuries.
Oh, it's yeah, this was just might, to that which, day yeah. of this action. Now, of course, every day dozens or if not hundreds of people are injured by Israeli security forces because as far as the security the Israeli state is concerned, these are all invading horde.
So they clash every day.
Yes.
It's not news.
On every block, in every square block in Israel cities, Israeli cities.
Isn't that the best way to create jobs, right?
What?
It certainly creates jobs here in America.
Bear with me here.
Yeah,
so let's say over in...
certainly security states create jobs, yes.
Well, no, I was just thinking if that guy's making shoes... then mm-hmm. someone else is therefore going to have to, after he dies, go there and make shoes for that town.
You mean it's creating opportunity?
Opportunity. And isn't that what jobs? I'm cutting yep. in and out here. Sorry.
Yeah. What's happening?
I'm not sure. But right, with that, we can go back to...
You might be touching it in the wrong place.
I touch things.
Hopefully with consent.
With consent.
On Friday, less than 30 minutes, reporters saw 10 people bullet wounds carried away on stretchers at one of the demonstrations. More than 1,400 people were wounded, mostly by bullets, but also rubber-coated rounds and tear gas inhalation. Tear gas is a chemical weapon, by the way. Whenever it's used, whether it's on our streets or otherwise, yeah. it's use of chemical weapons. Israel is made right here in America. Israel said that his positioned snipers and responded to rioting Palestinians with dispersal means and firing towards main instigators. Snipers. It said the movement was a Hamas-orchestrated ploy. I'm not going to read what they said. The military pointed to what it said was an attempted shooting attack by a terror cell on the northern part of Gaza Strip. So that's their side. Both sides. The Israeli ambassador to UN, Danny Dannon. Ooh, another Dan. Shame on Dan's. The international community must not be deceived by what he called a well-organized violent terror gathering. Hamas, which backed the protest, because they're a political party, by the way, has fought three wars with Israel since 08, if you want to call them that. In the past few weeks, Israeli forces say they have caught people attempting to cut through the front. Okay. What makes all this possible? In part, is that we have a very strong Israel lobby. So for a little historical context, back in the 19th century, during all the socialist upheaval and what have you, there was a lot of xenophobia towards Jews in Europe, and even in tolerant liberal democracy France, there was a lot of bigotry towards Jews, which the primary instigation was called the Dreyfus Affair, where a Jewish but French military officer was accused of being a spy, and you know, because Jews are outsiders first and foremost, their loyalty to France is tenuous at best, and he's obviously, and so there was no evidence and he was convicted, so it led to Jewish/French intellectuals just kind of throwing up their hands and like, this integration thing isn't working. We join their institutions, we fight in their wars, we follow all the laws, and it's never enough. Mm-hmm. And that might sound familiar if you're Hispanic, black, or what have you. You know, immigrants that serve in the army and then they're deported. These stories crop up now and then recently. And so thus the Zionist movement began, and it started as being secular, just that there be a state for Jews. And it became then a state that is of Jews for Jews, and thus is part theocracy, part ethno state, and this the goals and the ideology were laid out during the First World War, a little bit after, especially during the interwar period, was when it was heavily lobbying the British Empire to hand over to allow Jews to first to settle there, which was legal immigration. But then it became, with British approval, we're going to just invade, more or less. And it was it's complicated, but war crimes were made. And these occurred post-World War II. And so there's a lot of history that I'm not...
And so people were pushed out of their homeland to make room for the Zionist nation known as Jerusalem.
Or Israel, rather.
Israel, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And... since then, they've just been acquiring more and more land, little by little, in these...
illegally, by the way, against international law, because treaties were signed in prior decades.
And they just keep
taking, and
they're not being followed.
And also enclosing Palestinians more and more.
Yeah, to the point where their villages are just open-air prisons. And they're starting to... take away their water rights by just siphoning water from under them, milkshake straws and all that, drinking their milkshake. But in this case, the milkshake isn't just profit-driven oil, but just their means of survival. And that's kind of just to put the pressure on more, just to almost get them to leave voluntarily. And just generally making life inhospitable. So with that, so that's just the context of why, say, a man like me, who was given a Jewish education and raised, went to shul, and went to Hebrew school, but year by year, I was more and more skeptical of this. Like, you know, we talk up Israel, how great it is, but then I'm also seeing stuff in the news that makes me think, makes me wonder. And eventually, I just finally just came to the realization and made the decision. It's like, I'm not going to be pro-Israel anymore. I'm not even going to make any excuses. It just either it needs to utterly transform, as in it needs to be a secular, actually secular government, which is a liberal democracy, because right now it technically isn't. It's like it's held up as a liberal bastion by the right and Democrats.
Yeah,
I love the idea of Israel being a nation. I just don't understand why they can't be more accepting of their surrounding areas. And I understand there's a lot of violence on both sides,
mm-hmm.
You know, from history, so to speak.
But it's a kind of a question of who started it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that would be the British Empire started it. And and any violence, like the Antifadas, are resistances. Their responses to the oppression, the expansion, the colonialist project, as it were, and the creation, and explicitly that this is a Jewish state, meaning if you're Muslim, then you're just kind of not a full citizen. Though there are all these Christians and Muslims who are apparently Israeli citizens, it's like, but what does that take? And why aren't all these other Palestinians who just either wanted to share the land, or, like, you know, the compromise was the split in half,
mm-hmm.
but that obviously hasn't worked because one side was always acting in bad faith. They want all of it. It was never about having half, because you have the hyper conservative Jews that are about all of it, and they treat Palestinians like garbage. They literally talk about them like they're animals,
mm-hmm.
that we should just kill them all.
I've seen lots of videos where it's
disgusting.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And those, and now they're basically running the government now, by the way. So the compromise is totally transforming what Israel is. Certain proposals, like making it like an international country or something where anyone can just go. It challenges, you know, challenges empire, challenges U.S. dominance to do that, and so on. So anyway, with that, I'm going to go to, the site is called Motto Dice, News and Opinion About Palestine, Israel, and the U.S., because the U.S. relationship with Israel, if you don't know, is this concrete. It's like, we're the friend of Israel, because they were an anti-communist bastion. It was all about how anti-communist they were. Because Arabs, they lean socialist.
Irony.
Mm-hmm. And,
well, I mean,
Cold War is over, by the way, but we're going to keep, but now they're a bastion of anti-terror.
Right.
It was pretty easy to switch. They're
a foothold in the Middle East.
Yeah. So, that older Jews are officially terrified of young Jews' views of Israel. That is the title, written by Philip Weiss. So, Mondo Weiss is his blog site, apparently. And this was shared. I got this via my many stories via Facebook, and it's talking about me, guys. So let me just read parts of this, or maybe bits. Big stories don't break; they ooze. The legendary editor Gene Roberts used to say. And a story has oozed in the last month or so that has not gotten much attention. Older Jews are now officially terrified of young Jews. Why? Because those young Jews are not persuaded of the value of the great Jewish project of the last century, Israel. I can point to four fearful statements from the conservative Zionists. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, Ron Lauder, David Harris, Daniel Gordas. Three of these men hold very powerful positions, and two of them state frankly that the young Jews are an existential threat to Israel.
Whew.
Like terrorists.
Well,
strong words.
We're terrorists.
I was about to say better than internal threat. Or.
It's
a threat nonetheless.
Yes. Their statements underline just how much power young Jews have. They are I mean, just the fact that, you know, people change, groups change over time in the long term. They are catalyzing the crisis of Zionism inside of Jewish life. And the statements prove, by the way, a truth we have long insisted on here. Israel depends for its existence on the Israel lobby, Jewish political advocacy here in the U.S. Ron Lauer, the head of the World Jewish Congress, wrote a now famous op-ed in the New York Times a week ago. Let me give a date of when this was written. March 27th. So very recent. So we are talking about last week. Israel was delegitimizing itself through its failure to curb settlements and its descent into a right-wing theocracy. People got hung up on Lauer's claim that Israel is driving young American Jews to intermarry. But this key assertion was that the alienation of American Jewish millennials is endangering Israel's very existence. Because it is a colonial project. Like America itself, it depends on new people coming in and displacing the people already there. So here's a quote from him. And it's okay if I use a funny voice. Over the last decade, I have visited Jewish communities in over 40 countries. Members of every one of them expressed to me their concern and anxiety about Israel's future and its relationship to diaspora Jewry. An increasingly number of Jewish millennials, particularly in the U.S., are distancing themselves from Israel because its policies contradict their values. No, duh. The results are unsurprising. Assimilation, alienation, and severe erosion of the global Jewish community's affinity for the Jewish homeland.
I'm really looking forward to the Jewish government rebuttal, almost like a public service announcement, trying to get these young Jews, and I put that in quotes, back on their side, like, hey, come on down and kiss the wall. It's the hip thing to do.
Just wait until the last part.
Oh, God, okay, sorry.
It's coming. Senator Chuck Schumer also describes these. I'm not going to do an impression of him, I guess, but I can put my glasses down on my nose.
I can see the resemblance.
Also describes these young Jews as an existential threat. In early March, he had an hour's lunch with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He reports, and quote, this is the subject because it is so important, the disaffection of young Americans from the Jewish state. Yeah, he's such a great communicator. The greatest threat to Israel in the short term is Iran. We know that. But the long-term danger for Israel is something we don't think about enough. The young people in America do not know Israel's story. Or we're actually learning what the Israeli story actually is. Aside. If you look at the polling data, they don't know what Israel has gone through. And their support for Israel is declining. In every part of the country, every age group, even the evangelical young people's support for Israel is declining, much like for the Democratic Party that he's the leader of. Schumer went on to offer various prescriptions to overcome Palestinian publicity and alert the young people to the truth. One of them, to legislate against the boycott movement as anti-Semitic.
Right, yes.
Which is happening here in New York, as there was legislation proposed, and I forget if it was basically to defund any college group that supported the boycott, divest, sanction movement, which is the kind of nonviolent, we're going to boycott Israel since instead of, you know, using rockets and antifadas, we're going to be nonviolent. We're going to use the Martin Luther King / Gandhi way, and apparently that's anti-Semitic and terroristic too. They can't win. Sorry, you're in deep thought, Jeremy, so it looks like you're about to say something.
I'm trying to think of, I mean, like, technically it is anti, it's not anti-Semitic, it's more just
anti-Israel.
It's anti.
But remember, Israel's a state.
Persecuting a certain group of people because they live, it's anti.
Geography.
War. It's anti-colonialism. Yeah. It's not necessarily anti.
You get it. You get it. And I don't know, because I didn't watch any of the debates on it, but none of, that wasn't the argument made by Democrats or supportive people in our state government. It was just a matter of free speech rights. And that was how you could only defend it that way. Because we're a war country with a war economy. And you can't actually be anti-war and an elected official. It's dangerous. You don't see it at all. If you're anti-war, you end up like Kucinich. You know, they're rare. Even Sanders, not anti-war, not anti-empire. It got him a lot of criticism from the left. And
well, what are you just going to roll over and let people walk all over? This is, sorry.
I mentioned it on Thursday. It's like defensive capabilities. We could still have defensive, you know, defend the homeland, as it were.
Mm.
Yeah. But just take a look at, say, Japan's self-defense force. And there's a fight there. So they've been able to defend themselves, as it were, defend the Japan, you know, the actual main archipelago, with U.S. bases around them to project for offensive capabilities. But they've always had defensive capabilities. Mostly what they do is, search and rescue, actual public service stuff, instead of blowing up the world. So back to the article.
And Japan's doing pretty well as far as economy, education.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the
how many parties do they have in their political system?
European social...
Couple dozen.
Yeah, I would think. Yeah. I mean, just the amount of mascots they have per town. I would think they'd have a lot of.
Every town has its own commie.
Yes, it's amazing.
But I will point out that it's really just two main parties that also. Well, actually, it's really just one, and then a slightly opposition party, but it's, you know, the main party works in coalition with others, put it that way. Back to the article. So done with Schumer's quotes and how great he is. Then this week, the American-Israeli author David Gordis warned in the Jerusalem Post that if war breaks out between Iran and Israel, progressive American Jews, and he puts progressive in quotes, won't back Israel. Yeah. With his unusual condescension to Americans, Gordis blames young universalist Jews, including the non-Zionist group, if not now, which formed after Israel's last war/massacre in 2014. His quote, "The instinctive apathy of American Jewish progressives to the very idea of Jewish sovereignty is the real reason for the lambasting of Israel by so many young American Jews who spend much more time worrying about Palestinians than they do about the African Americans or Native Americans in their own communities. Ultimately, their cause is not justice for all. Their cause is an assault on Jewish sovereignty, which itself is a challenge to the universalism and their need to feel utterly comfortable as Americans."
I mean, just to go back, did he say that we have more care for the Palestinian nation than we do for
people, black and brown people?
For black,
yeah.
Basically,
right.
Okay. I was just wondering.
He's
I didn't want to put words in his mouth, but I was just
these curious. Insecurities aren't going to project themselves, Jeremy. They're just not. That's a go-to phrase when neocons like this guy talk like this. So, lastly, David Harris of the American Jewish Committee castrated the young for their hostility to Israel at a Westchester synagogue last November. A man of nearly 70, who makes upward to $500,000 a year, stands at a pulpit chanting, "Where did we go wrong in our homes and schools?" Now, this hits home.
Does he want a list? Or
There's a reason I talked about the violence.
I can think of about 500,000 reasons.
Where they went wrong. Well, they're fascists. I mean, you could sum it up like that. Not Nazis, of course, but just when your goal's an ethno state, you're going to have genocide. I came to this conclusion at the age of, right after I had my bar mitzvah, where it's like, and it's basically learning about the actual, technicalities of the Holocaust, the politics behind it, the social and the economic, you know, that it just wasn't evil. It was all these things that were part of it, and the ideology. And I'm like, well, what makes the Zionist ideology different than the ideology of Liebenstrom, living space, which was part of Nazi ideology, or manifest destiny of slaughtering Native Americans in our wake with market mechanisms, by the way. People were given a bounty for each Indian scalp they collected. That's where scalping came from, by the way. It was wet. It was Europeans that did it first. So, okay, I'm going to read this all out. This is great. We have 5 minutes left. Every time, I'm going to read it out like a this rabbi who's in Manhattan. Anyway, every time I hear in a Jewish meeting.
You got to go a little bit deeper.
Mm-hmm. Every time I hear in a Jewish meeting concerns about our children and their lack of interest in Israel, their apathy about Israel, their hostility to Israel, to me it's extraordinarily painful. And I ask myself, where did we go wrong? Where did we go wrong? No, 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 Israel is not a perfect country. We are a permanent work in progress. But Kuwait. As someone once said to me, I will visit Israel for the first time when they achieve peace. Nuts! First of all, they're depriving themselves of the privilege of visiting Israel. Secondly, they're handing to the Palestinians the decision when to visit Israel, if ever. Why? Why can't we convey to our own children successfully? Why can't Jewish day schools and synagogues in their after-school programs convey successfully a sense of unbridled joy and pride and thrill that in our lifetimes, the prayer, Lashana Hachaba La Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, has become this year? What is it? What is it that allows us to ignore this extraordinary journey? The journey that Churchill once said was a journey not to be measured in years or decades, but centuries and millennia. In the extraordinary excitement of the Jewish people returning to their land, and rebuilding their state and defending their state, what is it that brings shame among some? What are we doing wrong in our homes? What are we doing wrong in our schools? These four laments show, back to the writer, how much power young Jews have. Non-Zionism is the Jewish version of the Florida high school gun control movement and the hashtag MeToo movement. A new generation's disavowal of the crimes of the fathers, and it's panicking the establishment. That
Dan, first off, let me just say, your reading was almost spot on.
Mm-hmm.
It was very. I thought I was back in synagogue.
It's the way we read the our Haggadah this Passover.
I think you gotta almost run
happy
out.
Happy Passover, everybody!
Happy Passover. But
slavery's bad. Sorry, go on. I had to.
I just think you have to take longer breaths. Is all. This is just me working on your character work.
Oh, of course.
A little bit longer breaths. Longer pauses in between.
I got nothing on my cousin.
I would love to hear.
He made me crack up every year by basically reading deadpan like his rabbi, and
I love how in the article the rabbi. He is a rabbi, I'm assuming, right? Is that
no?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Of course not.
I apologize. This guy who makes $500,000 a year,
being a speaker,
he's saying that Israel is such a great place, and visiting it, it's almost like feeling that inertia or feeling that thing. Wouldn't you want everyone to feel that, not just your fellow
Jews?
Or no, that's not
it's
how.
It's an ethno-state project. This is a project for Jews, and he's referring to Birthright, by the way, which is a. Pretty much, I don't know how the money flows, but basically these rich Jews in America fund young Jews to a free trip to Israel, and between the ages of 18 and 26, I think.
A guided tour.
So I was actually doing the whole, like, well, when there's peace, when there's actually, like, a new peace settlement, and thus there's no risk, I'll go. But then it turned into... Well, if I go, it will be, I would like to do it on my own terms, because I learned that it is a guided tour. You're shuttled everywhere. You're basically babysat, and there's all these little steps, because the whole point of the trip is to get you to stay,
yeah,
to marry
yeah.
a nice Jewish girl.
Yeah.
And you're literally like, there's like a mingle party or something of like, you know, you meet local Israeli girls, singles.
Dan, where is this nice Jewish girl? You didn't go on this trip?
No, I refused.
Okay.
I was like, it was a matter. First, it was a matter of putting it off, and then it was just by when I had a few years left. I'm like, I was so disgusted with the state of things there. It's like, well, when they stop being an apartheid state, I guess. But that, when will that happen?
I'm just saying, it could have been the Four Left show with this. With your nice lady friend.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Three Left does not refer to the number of people in the room.
Well, today it kind of.
I'm trying to get femme voices in here. But they're all so busy. Anyway.
Is this a plug to any left femme voice?
Yes, please. Please
call in.
Join us.
Call in.
Call in, join us. I was not looking at the, and we've got into a conversation about what does it mean to be Jewish when you're a secular guy like me, an atheist, that's an ethnicity, not a race, just like any other ethnicity. You know, there doesn't need to be a, there, you know, you call Germany the German state, I guess we do, but what it means to be German is like it's nation states or it's citizenship. What, you know, it's based on citizenship, not ethnicity or religion. These are the things that create totalitarianism and genocide and all that bad stuff.
And ethnostates. And
yeah. So, and that's what, you know, the neo-Nazis want. And that's why they have to be stopped every turn. We'll cover that. So just to get back to, the panic is spreading to Israeli leadership as Chuck Schumer related in his lunch with Netanyahu. Here's a laugh to end this story. Oh, because we need to, because Jewish culture is all about bringing the humor.
I'm going to say my laughs weren't good enough.
No, it's fine. It's fine. The story, the country's Ministry of Diaspora Affairs has lit on a new way to counter the boycott movement by watering down the influence of American Jews.
Oh, yes.
Noah Landrieu in Haaretz, which is Israel's main propaganda rag, Israel is mining Jews in other countries. A committee appointed by Israel's Diaspora Affairs, this is not what he sounds like, minister says that there are some 60 million people around the world with an affinity to Judaism or Israel. The committee says that among them, there are committees that could be brought to Israel and converted to Judaism. This is what, this shocked me. Because, okay, so I'll get into
why. Yeah, they're
why.
Proselytizing.
The committee's recommendations call for reaching out to these communities and introducing them to content related to Israel and Judaism. By the way, if Trump campaigns with their Facebook memes swinging elections scares you, then you should learn about how the Israeli Defense Forces have their own battalions of Facebook trolls and sock puppets. Whenever a debate about Israel occurs, there will be, is guaranteed, there will be a member of the IDF trolling and going, but, you know, and making these either devil's advocate. What about the violence by the Palestinian dogs? And it's just ugly, ugly, ugly.
So it's really just about a body count here. They're just looking for bodies to bring in. And
yeah. So to clarify, there's two ways religion spreads. There's vertical, which has always been the Jewish way, which is just through population and having children. And you always you don't intermarry with people of other ethnicities or religions. You keep it in, and because you're the chosen people, you don't dilute that. So throughout Jewish history, there's always been kind of a purity bit in there.
Which
has always kind of irked me, and that's why, you know,
in large numbers is okay, but once you kind of get a pretty small gene pool after a while of.
But there was probably always intermarrying happening. It just wasn't recorded or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So, or you just had a population that was big enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So, or mixing between Jewish communities.
So now they're kind of going horizontally where they're trying to convert
non-Jews, which has always been like the selective process where usually when someone is intermarrying, like my sister-in-law, she converted. For reasons of her own volition, to do that. And in this case, it's like, so they're heavy on the vertical too. Like the settlements grow exponentially because you have these conservative Jews that don't use birth control, and they're in fact they're subsidized to have as many children as possible, and their education is paid for, and they don't have to serve in the military. These communities are the super orthodox, they're the people that like spit on you for anything, and they're just learning about them just maybe that they're tolerated within this in Israel. It's like if Israel was truly this tolerant, nice, liberal place, this big group of people wouldn't. They're supported by the state, you know. It's just added to the pile of travesties. So that just shocked me. Like the BDS movement's definitely working because this is like desperation. It's like we're gonna go out into the world and find communities that I guess are also fascist and believe in ethno states. Say, hey, would you like to be part of our ethno state? And be part of a homogenous group of, you know, that's in control and get over this chaos of mixing together and blah, blah, blah. Anyone with
oh, man, this sounds like
so
the beginning of a bad Bond movie.
It is. I mean, where do you think Bond stories come from? I mean, they're inspired by real life events, the Cold War, the geopolitics.
If you had to call this this clash something, Dan, what would you describe it as?
A massacre.
Massacre. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
And similar to that.
Like looking back on this time, maybe 20 years from now.
Wounded Knee was a massacre.
Yeah.
And all the other times that our government sent out the troops to kill people we didn't want around. Because we didn't want to accommodate them, we thought our way was better, and that's American ideology. Yeah. I mean, it's something to be aware of, and know that when it's brought up on the nightly news or by commentators on cable news, that's what's being represented and more of it. But now, here in the 21st century, in this globalized economy, we're going to still worry about borders and nation states. You know, I mean, the nation state itself is being challenged in our days, and its days are numbered. Just as the way countries were organized in the Renaissance and the medieval era, that came to an end with the nation state being kind of replacing it. Which was what kind of occurred during the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
The treaty is called the Treaty of Westphalia, and that kind of declared it was the exact terms would escape me, but it was basically the European monarchs agreeing that the nation state was what makes a country sovereign. So, if you have a nation state, you know that's what makes you legitimate, and thus. We'll make a treaty with you. If you don't have a nation state,
then you're barbaric. Or
then you're a barbarian. We're not going to treat you with any respect, which was basically any native peoples being colonized. So that's why it was important. Like, oh, these people don't have a nation state with a set border. So we can just put down our own and say, well, we're legitimate because we have a nation state. And if they don't, they're just going to have to deal with it. Because we're better and more civilized, as it were. So just a quick fact, awkward pause because there's no good segue here, except that, you know, to oppose fascism here in America is Antifa. And so I just wanted, like, so this is just a quick news segment. So Antifa is winning against the alt-right and the neo-fascists. The neo-fascists have even some of them, like Richard Spencer, famous for getting punched on J20, has admitted defeat, saying Antifa is winning. We can't organize effectively. Everywhere I go, he's canceled his speaking tour. So, and it's like mission accomplished almost. But because the point of shutting down, like no platforming, is about robbing the far right from the ability to organize. So because then five guys turn into 20. And they are actually actively killing people. Like, these groups are actively murdering people right now. So it is about actually protecting people, not hypothetical.
I mean, I would just say don't celebrate yet, though. I mean, I would think it's...
Yeah, it's not over.
It's still... I mean, one battle, winning, yeah. Not big war.
Winning, not won.
We're, yeah, I would say...
Like, in the early exchanges of a protracted...
Because I could see him admitting defeat being a cry for help, so to speak.
Yeah.
From all sides. Not from all sides, but... Mm-hmm. Whatever deep dark net he reaches out to,
but I'll point out that the organizations, these neo-fascist organizations, they're all fighting each other now.
Okay,
about like their tactics, just as the left usually does.
Yeah, yeah.
But now they're not united at all. Unite the Right actually did the opposite. So this is from the Daily Banter. And how Antifa broke the alt-right, sustained harassment of white nationalists has led to the once organized movement to fall apart. What a damn shame. Written by Justin Rosario, March 21st. So this is a week ago where I saved it. Has a video. The Antifa first appeared in the American lexicon. Media rushed to pass judgment on them as the flip side of the alt-right. Extremist. Leftist bent on violence. Oh, woe is America. The problem with the narrative is that Antifa, as I've explained before, has no political ideology beyond don't be an effing fascist. There is no such thing as an Antifa party or candidate. There can't be. The sole organizing principle is to fight fascism by any means necessary. The media seized on the violence of Charlottesville to discredit Antifa and almost completely ignored the iceberg under that tip.
Mm.
Fortunately, so did the white nationalists of the alt-right, who haven't operated out in the open in decades and weren't prepared for a highly organized resistance at all. How did the thugs of Antifa accomplish this? Yes, there was violence when white nationalists got it in their heads that they could go full brown shirt. This is a critical stage.
Full brown shirt?
Yeah, because they'd go out in their regalia.
Oh, yeah, right.
Oh, I thought that's because they didn't want Antifa to see when they crapped their pants. I wasn't sure.
That is one
I, for some reason, thought they were making pants. A Serenity connection, and I'm like,
what? Oh.
No, no.
Oh. Like, well, that's...
What? No.
Well,
like
hell,
them like giving up, and it's almost like their white flag is the brown shirt, or
frickin' Josh Whedon trying to,
oh no,
basically nor like make the brown like the term brown shirt mean something the opposite. So just so context, in Serenity, or rather, what was the name of the show?
Firefly.
Firefly. Brown shirts were like the resistance to the Empire in this in his world. And in real life history, brown shirts were fascists in the streets, because they wore brown military garb. This was the Nazi Party shock force, as they would go out and they'd harass people, break shop windows of Jews, and so on. You know, just the whole gamut of anyone who wasn't seen as being a proper German.
So brown shirt meaning camouflage. That's pretty much, is that
urban
kind of
camo,
what urban camo, or
whatever.
That's their
just bland their colors. Bland colors, though.
Don't stand out.
This is a critical stage of the fight. Let's see. You may not approve of the violence of Antifa, but it does serve a purpose. You may also not be aware of it, since it wasn't part of the media's narrative. But Antifa literally saved the lives of unarmed peaceful protesters. White nationalists were going to stomp into the ground because they thought they could get away with it, and they would have. But aside from the violence, and they get away with it all the time, where there isn't push, like where there isn't the shouting, triggered lefties to get in their way. Because the more they're having these inane arguments, which if you do a like YouTube search for radical left, that's all you see, these from the right or these trolls filming, oh, how silly all these people with ideology are.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, the more that the right is arguing in an inane way with Antifa people, they're not organizing and talking to normies and people who might not know, they won't know better.
Almost like you can't change or teach an old dog new tricks. There's no changing these social right, these Nazis, so to speak. I don't know how else to call them. I'm not out to call people Nazis, but there's no changing them. There is changing the views on the community of what your cause is or what your message is.
Yeah. There's problems in optics, but that's just a matter of you have non-Antifa members or people who don't participate directly who will take the right side and use the right's framing and talking points, even when they agree with the goals of stopping fascists, they'll just say, oh, but we can't no platform. And so they'll use rights language. Right. And that's the terrible optics of bumping them up in the public sphere. So going back to the article, but scrolling down a bit. But then there's the less public work. Antifa is exposing the identities of white nationalists to their families, friends, and coworkers. The alt-right likes to fancy itself the majority of America, but the fact is most people don't like fascists, and no one wants to employ them. I've written about... Now, of course, the same could be said for people who identify as socialist or anarchist, so it's a double-edged sword. And
yeah, no one wants chaos, or not even chaos, questionability in there.
People will go to organize the fellow employees.
Yeah, that's...
Because, they're union people.
Somehow you slid by, Dan. I don't know how. No, I'm just kidding.
We're very accepting at Shop.
Yes, yeah.
I've written about how your run-of-the-mill racist keeps getting fired for letting their hate go public, but it's far worse when people find out you're a piece of Nazi. Unfortunately, Antifa has been so effective at disrupting the gatherings. See, yeah, there's no fear. Okay, so this is definitely a left-winger writing this, of course. Fortunately, Antifa has been so effective at disrupting the gatherings of like-minded monsters that the monsters gave in to their natural inclination of infighting that's always kept them from uniting. Antifa has also made it dangerous socially and financially to openly be a white nationalist, and even more dangerous to get together to look for people to attack. The press isn't interested in the story because it doesn't fit their narrative of Antifa as just the flip side of the alt-right. But when the history books are written, one of the most important chapters may very well be how a misunderstood movement dedicated to fighting fascism saved America from the next birth of the Nazi Party. Not a bad legacy for a bunch of thugs.
Those millennials. Maybe.
So this is really... this is shorter than I thought it was, actually. It's not detailing... the actual local recent events, but hey, that's what I remembered.
Just coming from a man on the street perspective.
Yeah.
If you were to describe Antifa, it's not necessarily...
It's almost a tactic itself.
It's a tactic itself to fight Nazism.
Huh?
Antifa is entirely a tactic. It's
of confrontation.
And realistically, it's not to fight free speech, or it's more to fight the violence that comes after that free speech that's being said.
It's so stopping someone from yelling fire in a crowded theater by putting your hand over their mouth or, shushing them, as it were, to use that metaphor.
And realistically...
Which is ironic, considering the court case was referring to people handing out anti-war pamphlets.
I mean, I like the idea that that's the best I've heard of it. Because, I mean, realistically, in the news, Antifa is portrayed as this terrorist organization. Not terrorist, but this...
Select Eclipse.
Riot, inciting.
Mm-hmm.
When realistically, you guys are just trying to... When I say you guys, I mean Antifa. You got the Antifa is just trying to battle further fascism.
Well, it's like direct action versus the indirect fascism.
It's like you're not going
to
sit here.
We're not collecting petitions against fascism. We're actually going to disrupt their organizing.
You're not going to sit there and watch the kid play with matches next to the gas station. You're going to grab those matches and put them out.
Right.
And if the kid fights back...
So a version of that is grabbing the Nazi flag and then ripping it up,
which on both sides,
it's so rude, but it's
rude.
That's the way we're seeing it.
But yeah, I could see it being done. I mean, I wouldn't personally do it, but I could.
I personally haven't done it myself, but I have friends who.
What about the
culture? Now kind of.
What about the culture of that
Nazi flag?
Man,
I would rip the flag right off their backs.
Okay. I mean, I understand, inciting
the
violence.
Positives.
I want to see that guy out there holding his Nazi flag because I want to make fun of him and say, "What are you kidding me? Like, you don't mm-hmm. see." And I would want to change his mind with words versus punching him in the face.
Well, you see, for every person who just will make fun of them, like a liberal or mm-hmm. or moderate, say how ridiculous, like he's outside. That applies to anyone outside the Overton window. And it applies to me. The police, you know, when it comes to police oppression, it's on leftists more than these right wingers. They get to go out like the police and harm people, and they're not charged with anything. Boys will be boys, is mm-hmm. what's said mm-hmm. time and time again. But if you break a window, you've committed like worse than murder. And then there's a joke that after such a riot, the group that broke the windows bought a bunch of panes of glass and brought them out and say, like, well, we can be even. You can break our windows. But no one apparently took them up on it.
I would have broken the windows just because I like breaking glass. Mm-hmm. And that's not.
Don't even cathartic about
inciting
it.
any sort of breaking window. Mm-hmm. Please don't do this at home. No. But going back to that guy standing on the street corner, when it's not just one guy, he'd be stupid to stand on the street corner, I would say. But like, I would just want to talk to him and say, I would love to live in an ethno state too. I think I'm a cool guy. If there were 100 of me, we'd make a pretty cool town. But
right.
I like pizza, and I don't want to eat pizza every single night. I want to switch mm-hmm. it up.
You want to have Mexican
sometimes. I want to have, yeah, dude, I love enchiladas. I love yeah. lasagna. I love...
Latkes.
Don't get me started on latkes. But, because I love them so much.
Oh, we'll break.
Solidarity.
Moon shines brightly in the night sky. River flows from south to north. With changing of the seasons, the birds migrate back and forth. They say that you can't come here, not in the light of day. Somebody has got plans for you. Starve at home or hide away. Will we open up the borders? Tear down the prison walls. Declare that no one is illegal. Watch the giant as it falls. So much travels across these borders. So much is bought and sold. One way goes the gunships. The other comes the gold. Free trade is like a needle drawing blood straight from your heart. The border's like a prison, keeping friends apart. Will we open up the borders? Tear down the prison walls, declare that no one is illegal. Watch the giant as it falls. Walls come down. May we meet our sisters and our brothers. Stand arm in arm there in the daylight, no longer fighting one another. Will we stand together? For therein lies our might. Will we understand these words? Workers of the world, unite. Will we open up the borders? Prison walls, declare that no one is illegal. No one is illegal. No one is illegal.
All right, welcome back to the Three Left Show. In our second hour, it's about 11:30 now. This is WCAA LP Albany. We have a voice in Albany.
Yes, we do.
And so... That was a nice little ditty. I really like that artist.
I enjoyed that song. I'd never heard it before, but who was that?
David Vorvax.
David Vorvax.
Or Vorvix. folk singer of sorts. And he's, unlike a lot of other folk singers, he has that higher tempo. To me, higher tempo is key for music.
He must have listened to Mozart. He must have been a fan.
I don't know. But,
or Beethoven.
We interrupted the house hour or whatever was, you know, all the house music from before, which is great that a community station like ours can just play house music on Saturday morning.
It's a great way to wake up Albany.
Mm-hmm.
Or put to sleep Albany from the night before. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So next, we're going to shift gears to more environmental activism to give you. So we were talking about tactics, you know, with Antifa against a particular ideology. But what if it's the very infrastructure of our country, referring to fossil fuel or our infrastructure? Mm-hmm. That is, we can't have more of it. For the background position. Each new piece of fossil fuel infrastructure is the guarantee, economic guarantee, that we will still be burning fossil fuels for another generation.
So fracking, not a solution.
I think that's been established here in New York.
Yeah, just a brief history.
But we're still importing fracking waste, and more important to current fights and struggles in New York and surrounding states is that any use of natural gas is going to be in part fracked gas. So the energy needs of New York and such will be met by the poisoning of people in other states in the West or Pennsylvania. Now, but another big part of that is that the U.S. is an energy exporter now. We meet all our energy needs by the energy revolution that is fracking and offshore drilling.
Yay.
Which is why it's been expanded by both Democrats and Republicans.
You wouldn't know it to hear them talk about the needing more pipelines. And
right, so that's actually where we're coming in here. So, story from The Independent. Anti-pipeline campaigners found not guilty by judge because, quote, protest against climate change crisis was a legal necessity.
Yes.
So this is really interesting.
It's good news.
Because and this was a nonviolent protest, by the way. So there's kind of two ways of dealing with this. It was still a direct action, though. They got into the pits that they were being dug. So it was kind of putting your bodies on the line temporarily because, you know, then you're arrested. And thus, in the court case afterwards. So let's go into details. More than a dozen protesters who clambered into holes dug for the high pressure gas pipeline known as the Spectra pipeline said that they were found not responsible by a judge after hearing the argue their actions to try and stop climate change were an legal necessity. Spokesperson for this group was Karina Gore, daughter of former Vice President Al Gore. Was the first I've ever heard of her being a climate change activist, was among more than 100...
I would think it's in the blood, right? It's got to run in the family.
There's a lot to say about Al Gore's climate change activism, but...
he definitely opened the eyes...
Of normies, certainly. Yeah. Of the people who weren't...
He
activated...
He saw that it was cool and made money off of it, I would think.
Yes.
He saw the...
That's the main area of criticism, that his suggestions for action were then counterproductive, and the policies put forward by corporate America even, or was just, they don't work. Like the climate, the carbon market, the cap and trade, it's not effective at all. Mm. And that, cause it was tried on the East Coast here. Okay. Among more than 198 people who were arrested. That's quite a number. Protesting the pipeline in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, a neighborhood of Boston. 13 people. So, by the way, so these pipelines that are being crisscrossed across our area and Massachusetts to the east, they're for exporting gas because these pipelines are going to the coast to export the gas to other places and China and Europe because there's more money to be made selling it abroad than just using it here in America,
right,
or keeping prices low. Because at the moment, they're too low.
I just love the idea. We have this extremely flammable gas that we have to export from one area to the other. What's the safest way to do it?
High pressure.
Let's go underground, under people's houses. Mm-hmm. And
Right. And if you want pictures of what that looks like when they leak or break, watch Gasland 2 or Gasland 1.
It's great footage.
For all the problems with that. I mean, that, you know, just like how... You know, the climate change movement in part was by an inconvenient truth. Gasland was important to that.
I mean, you can just Google pipeline leak and get tens of thousands of.
Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, Judge Mary Ann Driscoll of West Wexbury District Court found all 13 defendants. So I guess there were 13 people were going to trial. So the first of of the moats. These prosecutors downgraded their original criminal charges to one civil infraction. Isn't that bully for them? Probably all white. The equivalent of not guilty.
Yeah, I mean, it's Boston, Dan. It's
The equivalent of not guilty in a criminal case. Not challenging the underlying, you know, structures of capitalism, maybe? I don't know. She did so after each of the defendants addressed the judge and explained why they were driven to try and halt pipelines construction. So there's a video of that. See the story for later. Speaking outside the court afterwards, Miss Gore, 44, age 44, director. So she's the director of the Center for Earth Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York. So the court's decision was historic. The people were found not responsible by reason of necessity. The irony is that we are making ourselves responsible. We're part of the movement that is standing up and saying, we won't let this go by on our watch. We won't act like nothing's wrong. So I will point out, that's the end of what's important to me. And the same company building this pipeline is crisscrossing our county as well. And if you want to know about the local movements, the local movement to stop that is Google or look up Stop the New York Frack Gas Pipeline. It's a bit of a mouthful. They didn't come up with something pithier, but... It's mostly rural folks because it's actually affecting them, and they're able to organize people based around, like, I don't want this going through my backyard. So there's a bit of NIMBYism, but they're also being turned on of just how important it is to for the climate change, that their lands are also being flooded more during winter and all of that, and on all the effects that are occurring by via climate chaos and polar vortexes affecting us and so on. So, and there's also the more direct, which, you know, if you went to court, you probably would be criminally prosecuted, would be to actually actively sabotage pipeline equipment or the pipelines themselves when they're actually built by just turning a valve. So you don't actually have to break anything. You just turn the valve, you just shut it off. And that at least stops the flow for an hour or so until the service worker comes, you know, is called in to turn the valve back. And there's video of that, of the bad ass activists doing that work. But there's also, you know, and so to turn it out, why have nearly, so this is a related story in a different part of the continent, in Canada, covered by Vice. Why nearly 100 pipeline protesters have been arrested this week. Construction on Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain expansion has been ongoing for months, but this weekend will likely mark the biggest showdown yet. So what's the point of just, I mean, yeah, you're halting construction for a few days or even just hours sometimes by putting your body on the line and getting in the hole. Why do this? You know, is this really direct action? And here's an argument for yes, it does matter. It's a matter of the frequency, though. Frequency matters a lot. It's not once a month, not once a year, which is like just that's where it's a kind of a, you might as well not do it. But you're just making a point. Like if we in Albany, we blocked the bomb trains for one day, but really, a group should have been blocking the train tracks
24/7,
persistently,
or at least persistently. Multiple times a month.
Well, I mean, I think it's the same topic we brought up with why Occupy ended up failing, is the consistency of it. like we stopped.
It was a success. Was that it was
well? The success is that was, but then I'm sorry. All the movements since then mm-hmm. have really had no
right, no right. no base,
mm. no yeah, no
yeah,
no counter.
Besides offices that you have to pay rent for, and thus you need a nonprofit helping you, and nonprofits like following rules, so they'll like, oh no breaking things, no trespassing. If we trespass, we plan to be arrested, so it's fair play. And it's like, that's performative to me. I don't like doing that. I've yet to be arrested because I don't see a point in being processed for the sake of being processed, of following the rules, by accepting punishment as being fair. I trespassed, thus I must go to jail. That's like accepting things as they are to me. And I'd rather just be the toddler or go like, well, my foot's over the line now. Oh no! Oh no! I'm on the other side. Can't touch me. Be playful, not so serious. So, we've heard of the starting with the article. Let's see, written by Sarah Berman. Deadline, Dateline, March 23rd. We've heard the three-dimensional chess metaphor get tossed around a bunch on the evening news, most recently as a punchline in the latest Stormy Daniels versus Trump saga.
Which, by the way, when is that movie coming out? Is that...
In 2 years.
2 years? Okay.
Must be. Or 2 years after Trump leaves office.
And then the adult version will probably be out next week.
We don't have Obama movie yet. There will be one, though. How long it will take. I mean, let's see
well,
how
who's
long...
Who's going to play Obama? That's the real question. Morgan Freeman's too old.
Well, we've had plenty of black presidents who...
That is true.
Whatever.
There are some good...
But just think about how long before W was produced... after W left office.
So it's coming.
Yeah. But that's a particular director with a particular idea to follow through.
What would it really be called, though? That's the question.
Hope something.
Hope. Hopefully.
If you want to watch this movie, you can do that. No, that's
it's hopeful. That's very hopeful, Dan.
You didn't make this movie.
Actually, that would...
There we go. But if I were to earnestly apply this increasingly meaningless phrase, I'd like to settle on the pipeline batter currently playing out on Bradbury Mountain. Today, elected MP for Barnbury South, Kennedy Stewart, will join dozens of self-described land defenders attempting to delay and discredit the $7.4 billion Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion in hopes the project will never be completed. Since Saturday has seen an average of 15 Kinder Morgan opponents arrested every day around the Texas oil giant's Bradbury work site. So instead of a massive 200 people getting arrested, they're spacing it out.
Right.
That strategy. Why does this matter? For each protester who has zip-tied themselves to the gate or climbed on top of an excavator, cops have trotted out an exceptionally defensive strategy, reading court documents aloud, saying out legal opinions, in some cases negotiating for hours, and even ensuring post-arrest care for First Nation drums and other ceremonial items. When a grandpa built himself a hammock high up in some trees inside the construction area, Bradbury police waited until the cover of night to extract him, which is a very neutral way of saying they snatched him up.
It's like...
And dragged him out of bed.
Well, like, how do you get a bear out of a tree? You know, it's like, what are they...
Neutralized. They hit him with a dart.
They must have. There's no...
To an apparent,
or maybe he sleepwalks. Who knows?
An apparent play to avoid photos of the struggle. There's a reason for all these good-mannered optics on the part of the cops, and there's a reason protesters have been doing their part to escalate the situation this week. For years, opponents have pointed to the ongoing First Nations land claims and the unknown spill risks that come with a sevenfold increase in Metro Vancouver tanker traffic. So this is like Canada's DAPL, more or less. But the project was nonetheless approved by Justin Trudeau, pretty boy liberal, in 2016. Construction has been happening for months already, but this weekend will likely mark the biggest showdown yet, with 100 or more arrests expected Saturday, for arrests already totaling in the 90s and climbing. It's worth exploring how much damage these actions could actually inflict and what we can learn from the major players' tactics.
How much damage are they preventing?
Damage to the company.
To the cause, yeah.
To the project.
I know what they mean, but...
Like, but yeah, in doing so, they're also preventing much more damage. Just like punching a Nazi. It's a little bit of harm to prevent a lot of future harm. The land and water defenders have presented a simple and urgent strategy. Delay construction, scare off would-be investors leading up to the March 26th. Well, leading up to March 26th. When migratory bird protection laws may stop the company from clearing trees and other construction work until August. It's also quite possible construction will continue anyway.
Yeah.
Their latest twist on this theme was to go out and plant new cedar trees around the property Thursday to leave the place better than when we found it. Kinder Morgan's strategic position appears to be less comfortable. And this, is, by the way, applies to pretty much any corporation's PR. Between what they say they're doing and what they actually are doing. Kinder Morgan's strategic position appears, it's a contradiction of capital, as it were. Position appeals to be less comfortable as it's had to present conflicting versions of events to its shareholders and the courts. In court documents earlier this month, the company claimed, well, as it's had, those damage claims, so they've claimed damage, $89 million in lost revenue for every month the project is delayed, as well as hundreds of thousands more for weekly security, staff, and equipment costs. Those damage claims led to the creation of a 5-meter exclusion zone around the construction site, which police began enforcing soon after.
Of course.
Which is just enough time to cover the rest of this Vice article about the ongoing struggle in Canada between First Nation people protecting their land, the land that, and the environment that they value, that we should all value, from greedy corporate overlords that are, and it's important not to just put a moral, to moralize it, because they're not acting, that what they're doing is, you can say is immoral, but they're operating from a place of amorality. They're just following the money. They're doing what they see as profitable. Do you have a...
Oh, the companies.
Yes.
I mean, not the... Okay.
The logic of capitalism. Right. Not to focus on the individual people. I mean, yes, they are doing wrong by participating, and that's kind of... Maybe we can moralize that, but it's what it is. So, where we left off, we're looking into the economic costs of all of this protesting, that it was, in fact, having... almost the same effect as like a mass economic boycott where you need millions of people to participate, but it's much more strategic to just take a few hundred and disrupt operations, and which is much more illegal, and you get have more arrests. But it's, so let's get into what the actual, like, these effects, these figures, and the tactics, that it must be consistent, it must be like over a time. These figures came a little more than a week after the company assured investors in Toronto that it has secured. So we left off with them going to the courts and saying how much damage was being done, how much money this was costing. $89 million every month. These figures came a little more. But then to their investors, they say that it has secured 708,000 barrels a day worth of contracted capacity once the project is complete. While the presentation acknowledged several hurdles that could delay the project up to 12 months, the price of those delays weren't spelled out for financial backers. A slideshow explains, construction delays entail increased costs due to a variety of factors. However, as the extent of a delay is currently unknown, we are not updating cost estimates at this time. Between a rock and a hard place, Heidi Dalarabiada, a UBC, so I guess that's University of British Columbia professor, who studies global markets and resources, any talking device. In the court filings, they're really saying this is hurting us. To the shareholders, they're saying, oh no, we're fine. According to him, the viability of the Trans Mountain may be more uncertain than the company has let on. He says its lower medium credit rating suggests it owes steeper interest to Canada's major banks, and could be weakened by adverse economic conditions, like if the price of oil falls. In the past, Dalarabiad says Kinder Morgan's share price has gone up and down more or less in sync with the price of oil. but that hasn't been the case of late. Kinder Morgan's share price was quite high. And by the way, Kinder Morgan is also one of the companies involved with Dapple and all the,
right,
the Keystone and so on. Share price was quite high. Then back in 2015, the price of oil fell, so the company's share price fell, he told Vice. Since about 6 months ago, oil prices have been rising steadily, but the company's share price hasn't. This could mean a lot of things, but the professor suggests investor confidence in the company's largest and most ambitious project has been shaken. With all the risks they face in this huge pipeline project, it's a major part of future earnings. So are the daily arrest counts on Burberry Mountain actually contributing to that uncertainty? By Dalabiad's calculation, it is. But the company has also seen this face-off coming for years, and their careful legal maneuvering has managed to keep much of the conflict out of the national media.
Right.
Just like how in America, usually updates are now in the form of court dates and court decisions, which led to the failure. I mean, it's the mass oppression of the Dapple movement of Standing Rock. And once that was crushed with force, with violence, state violence, it then went to the courts. And then, you know, you can only, the courts can't, can only delay, you know, you're asking for injunctions and you can't really legally stop what the law was designed to help, especially then once the government isn't on your side. And it was barely on their side with Obama. He was like, he was calling it a clash when, when the police would not literally kill, but maim.
And he chastised the protesters for,
yeah,
for protecting their own land. I mean,
right. Like, not only did none of the Democrats visited, Jill Stein did, but not, none, Bernie Sanders didn't. Did he even send a representative or something?
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, Bernie was pretty busy back.
He was.
Back then, but,
well, Stein was running for president and saw it as part of her campaign to actually support people on the ground.
Oh, which is huge. I'm glad. Neither of them won, but not really. But I'm glad you brought up Little Rock, because I was thinking, if this was the U.S. government, this article is brought to you, it's in Canada, correct?
Mm-hmm.
If this was the U.S. government, I feel like the opposition to the pipeline would have been crushed already. It would have, there wouldn't, the prolonging of it is awesome. You know, it's,
well, the police are trying to put this nice face on it.
Yeah.
And they're not just shooting the
whereas if this was in Little Rock, they would have tear gassed.
Standing Rock.
I mean, they may
Standing
have
Rock.
Learned.
Oh, sorry, Standing Rock.
They may have learned from
Standing Rock
that,
even though that worked,
they may have learned from Standing Rock that the hit their reputation will take.
Mm-hmm.
Because the current failure of their stock prices to rise with the rise of oil prices probably has a lot to do with that.
Well, yeah, their goodwill, so to speak. I mean, that's a huge part of a company's assets is their view that the public has on their company and where they think it'll go in the future.
Especially in this post-commodity economy where the commodities are the brand.
Yeah,
and the
yeah.
PR. But that's not the case with these companies, which, to point out just how terrible, like, this is like for the tar sands or whatnot, and whatnot, and that's like, it's very energy inefficient. Like, you're putting 9 barrels of oil in to get 10 barrels back.
Yeah.
So
just for a little bit of profit,
and put a pop culture spin. The stories remind me of a thing that surprised me in Disney's Tomorrowland, a movie that was panned and not very popular. It had I agree that its third act was not good, and its ending, or its villain perhaps. But it's open. One of the opening scenes is the main character's father is a NASA employee, and he's being laid off due to cutbacks. And one of the launch pads that they live near is going to be demolished. And so one of the opening scenes is her blocking up and sabotaging the equipment there. Like, literally not just blocking it, but tearing electronics out to messing things up to delay it another week because she believes in the future and doesn't like what's happening with, like, this cutting back of NASA, which represents, among many other things, giving up on the future and not investing in it anymore. And so the messaging of Tomorrowland is really good, actually. It just needed tweaking. But I actually enjoyed it, a lot of it, just not the last 20 minutes. But I actually suggest people check it out, at least to make up their own minds about it.
It's a utopic society, right, in the future? Or
Okay, so it's not a spoiler. I don't know if it's kind of a spoiler, but basically a bunch of futurists go into this pocket dimension, and that's where Tomorrowland is.
Okay.
And so it's just like, if you have the right set of people, a bunch of geniuses, then you have something that's like utopia-like. And
so, like, the premise of The Village, going back to...
Yes. Yeah. But then it falls apart and becomes kind of totalitarian because they needed, like, new people to come in. So they would send out the little pins that the main character gets as an advertisement.
Almost like Israel is doing with the cross, horizontal.
Bringing it together, yeah. Yeah. So there are some overtones to Tomorrowland. And this is seen as being wrong, by the way.
And ethno, yeah.
So, but actually, the movie ends with them sending out people to recruit. Like, find the people who believe in the future and bring them together. And so, like... I would prefer going out and maybe organizing people out there, not bringing them to the pocket dimension. I think that was the idea, just using the pocket dimension as the safe place, the base from which to organize from, which is totally needed. And a base doesn't have to be physical, but a base of support, you know, people who regularly give with dues to organizations that they want to thrive and to build alternative institutions. So, which we desperately, desperately need, which, whether they're for energy or food or what have you.
Social welfare. So, for instance, a good, if you were to want to invest your money in investment, a safe way would not be to invest in Autism Speaks, because that is not.
Yeah, no.
It's a matter of time, yeah. good to wrap it around. I also want to point out that the local IWW chapter has started a general defense committee, and they've been having regular events and trainings. Today, they were doing one on first aid, so you can help heal people's wounds in the field. And these are skills we all should have one way or another, but they're not. They've been cut out of our education system because, you know, leave it to the professionals, as it were.
I would think make
which
it...
Which is the opposite of democracy.
Really. Make it a commodity. Make it so people have to pay to...
Yeah.
To
yeah.
Which is the learn real, life-saving yeah. skills.
Which is the real reason for doing that. It's not just, oh, we should just have as few people as possible know how to treat wounds. But it's a matter of being able to have to pay for that ambulance, pay for the Albany Med, which is actually organizing now. They have been for years. We're wrapping up. All right, and with that, this has been Three Left Show. Check out our Facebook page, Three Left Show, where we list all our sources and so on. And this has been Dan Platt.
Isaac Coffey.
And Jeremy Brock.
All right, thank you for joining us. Kick off the political block.